Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac DeVere. Today's guest, North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis. It's strange times in the Republican Senate conference these days. John McCain is proudly on a final mission to pull his party back from Trump and his conference back from furthering the unraveling of an institution he spent 30 years in. Tennessee Senator Bob Corker is teed off with the liberation of a politician who's personally popular among his colleagues and not running for re-election, leaving reporters asking all the other senators whether they do in fact believe everything he said, but just haven't spoken it out loud or on the record. The list goes on. Senators don't know what to make of Trump. They can't figure out when the House is going to get itself together. They're worried, for both policy and politics' sake, about not getting anything done. Few are excited about the prospect of Roy Moore from Alabama joining them if he wins in December. And now they're headed into what should be a layup midterm cycle, answering questions about whether Mitch McConnell should even be majority leader, and looking over their shoulders at what exactly Steve Bannon's up to. All of this was on Tillis' mind when we sat down in his office in Dirksen, the Senate office building, just across the street from the Capitol. Tillis was elected in the 2014 Republican wave, knocking out first-term Democrat Kay Hagan, but he'd already gained quite a bit of notoriety and fame from his time as Speaker of the North Carolina State Legislature. We had Roy Cooper, the new governor, on a few months ago, and he talked about how upset he is with what's happened to the way the legislature functions and the gerrymandered lines that favor Republicans. But of course, he's a Democrat, fighting against all that. Tillis is a man responsible for much of what he's fighting against, getting put in place to begin with. So that's the perspective that he arrived in Washington with, and with which he's looked at what's been going on in the Senate over the last year, and how he thinks things should go from here. Before we get started, I want to make sure you've all hit that subscribe button on Apple Podcasts or Panoply or whatever you're listening to us on, and you've rated us and told a friend. Episodes coming up, a really great conversation with Nancy Pelosi in which we covered everything from her telling her high school Model UN club she couldn't hang out with them because she was having dinner with JFK, all the way to what she makes of Donald Trump. Also coming up, Eric Holder, former Defense Secretary William Perry, talking about North Korea and nuclear war, and many, many more. Follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Isaac DeVere. Email me your thoughts and guest suggestions to isaac@politico.com. And now, my conversation with Tom Tillis. Can we start with a question that has, I feel like, has been bugging me a lot? What is with the H in Tom?
Well, it actually dates back to a rebranding decision I made when I was about 20 years old. I was watching Jeopardy, and like the longest winning contestant on there was a guy whose name was Tom. He spelled it with an H. So the following day, I decided to start spelling my name with an H. I was Tommy, and then I was Tom without an H, and then I became Tom with an H, which I maintain is at the age of 20, I recognized how to spell my name right.
And your brothers are also named Tom.
Yeah. Father Thomas Raymond, brother Thomas Richard, Thomas Ronald, son Thomas Ryan, nephew Thomas Roman, TRT.
Wasn't that confusing growing up?
No. My father was Tom. I was Tom. The other ones went by their middle name. What was particularly good, though, was when I got out of home when I was 17, I went to get my electric turned on, and they said, oh, you already have a service at XY address. I said, yes, I do. And at age 17, that deposit, not having to pay for it, was good. So it worked out okay for me. So,
but now you are the only Tom with the H in the,
right,
of the brothers.
Right.
So that's you distinguish yourself from your family that way.
That's exactly right. Tell us apart. That's how my mom tells us apart.
I want to get into a lot of policy stuff, but I feel like we should, before we do that, talk about Burning Man a little bit.
Mm. I want to go.
Why?
Well, because it's interesting. Actually, I was just down in Jacksonville Airport. I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida. And on Saturdays, I would go to Mass. I'm Catholic. I would go to Mass with my grandmother and grandfather. And after we finished Mass, we would go to McDonald's and eat. And then we would go to Jacksonville International Airport and watch people for about an hour or two. So that's really where I developed my interest in just observing humans in different settings. And Burning Man's about the most probably truly eclectic unique setting you can find people behaving.
Are you? Have you been reading up on Burning Man?
My son's gone twice.
Okay.
And I was aware of it before then, but he kept me up to date the 2 weeks that he was there with his girlfriend, soon-to-be fiancé. Yeah.
So it's not music. It's not. You just want to go look
at
the
people. It is music. I love music.
No, but that's not what's drawing you there.
It's more watching the spectacle and then catching a few good performances along the way.
I don't think anybody would expect a Republican senator from North Carolina of your age to be wandering through Burning Man.
I don't know if I should be insulted by that or not.
I mean, you got to get into the whole gear and everything.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah, but it's not too far off from how I dress on weekends. So it'd be kind of like being comfortable again.
And again, your path into politics is a weird one. It's a short path from first race to being in the Senate. You got into it because you wanted a bike trail originally.
Mm-hmm.
Can
right.
you just explain how that leads to someone pushing for a bike trail to sitting in the United States Senate in the course of 14 years,
yeah,
basically?
I lived in a town. I've always had boxers. I would take my boxer into these woods. I didn't know whose they were, but I was mountain biking at the time, and it really looked like a great trail that was not too far from my neighborhood. So I put together a proposal with the mountain biking club, trying to understand how to build a environmentally sustainable mountain bike trail. Put the proposal before the town board, and they convinced me that I may be able to get the trail done if I'd be willing to volunteer on the park and rec advisory board. And that led to another thing that led to the legislature and ultimately here in the Senate. And the mountain bike trail got built about 5 years ago.
So it worked.
It worked.
Funny because we're in this moment where there's a lot of there are a lot of people who are running for office for the first time, getting civically engaged for the first time, and thinking, can I make a difference even in their communities? You got the bike trail, but the bike trail gets you pretty much to the top of American politics pretty quickly, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I really, really wanted the bike trail. I didn't set out to run
that wasn't the plan for the
Senate. That's right. That just kind of happened.
And along the way, you become Speaker of the legislature in North
yeah.
Carolina. A lot happened while you were Speaker. The legislature changed a lot, and how business got done in Raleigh changed a lot. Can you talk about what that perspective does to how you think about your job now here in the Senate, and what needs to be changed, how things are going?
Well, we did a lot of changes, really dating back to at the end of my freshman term. I decided to challenge the long-serving minority whip to be the whip for the conference coming into my second term. And a lot of that was premised on the need to democratize our conference. Over time, we'd been in the minority for all but one other instance in 100 years. And we had this mentality where only a few people really controlled the agenda for the conference. So we spent a lot of time democratizing the conference to get more people engaged, to get more leverage out of the individual members. And I think that probably seeing that happen when we were in the minority is probably what laid the groundwork for the members to feel comfortable with electing me to Speaker, because we did the same thing. We completely revamped the way the House operations worked, and up to and including revamping the rules to show better respect to the minority. It's one of the reasons why I think we got such good cooperation on some key bills when we had a then Democrat governor who was vetoing some of our key reform measures, and we overrode them with Democrat support.
I think if you ask the Democrats in North Carolina, they wouldn't describe it as so wonderful in retrospect.
Right? Oh, except for the 18 out of 52 members who voted with us on one or more of 11 veto overrides. They didn't do that for fun. They did it because the policy that we were negotiating, they were all transactional, sort of bipartisanship, mm-hmm. so it wasn't all on the same measures, but I think that was an indication of we were willing to go where we needed to get bipartisan support for some pretty heavy lift reforms that are showing the impact today. And of course, there are going to be instances where I'm a conservative, they're liberal, we're not going to agree. We stay away from those things. But I've collaborated with some of the most liberal members on education reform, for example, and with fiscal conservatives on tax reform and on budget reform. It was more a matter of just trying to figure out how you create that unique set of policy that would cast a wide enough net to move forward when I didn't have a supermajority.
And now there is a supermajority among of Republicans in the legislature, and the lines have been changed for the district maps. Obviously, that's in the middle of court challenges at the moment.
Right.
But I mean, there are the complaints about your some of the problems that people point to. They say, well, there were bills that were shoved through in the middle of the night or without a hearing, that kind of stuff. The expression on your face is not a man who feels like those have much weight.
No, well, I mean, part of it, it's just like up here in D.C.
Yeah.
When people are fundamentally opposed to the policy, they start screaming process. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is we didn't break a single rule. We live by the rules. In fact, when we revised the rules, we made it difficult to move things through very quickly. We created a rule where if a conference report, the old day was, the Democrat leadership would appear to be kind of going through the process. Then they'd create a conference report. They would stuff everything in the conference report, bring it back to the floor with no notice whatsoever, and force you to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, that didn't seem like a bad policy. I thought it was, which is why we changed the rules to require any conference report that had substantially different language than was in either of the two bills, it had to go back to a committee before it could be voted on the floor. So I mean, people cop out to the process narrative. Quite honestly, I don't think most people in the United States care about the process. It just spins up good here in Washington, D.C. People are judging us based on results. And I think the tax reform bills, a lot of the bills that we did in the legislature have had an enduring value that it's hard to debate the result.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they may not like the process, but if they don't like the process, change the rules. Otherwise, you should use whatever rules are available to produce the outcome.
Do you feel like things are working well in the North Carolina legislature?
I think that the legislature's done a good job on tax reform, adding to what we started back in 2011, 2013. You always have the unique challenge when you get super majorities of a given party. The leader, their biggest challenge is to make sure that they do not go too far.
Mm-hmm.
What you don't want to do is really get to a point to where you're not representing the electorate as a whole. I think one of the reasons why I feel like we came pretty close, you could pick one policy or another and say it was too conservative for North Carolina, but speakers of the House haven't done a particularly good job running for statewide office after they've served a speaker in North Carolina. And I think
it's not just in North Carolina.
Yeah. Well, because of the trade-offs you have to make. And and some of that's appearing to be too moderate.
Mm-hmm.
And so it exposes you in a primary. But I think on the whole that one of the reasons that I'm U.S. Senator is because of what we got done, not in spite of it.
Mm-hmm. So you're a person who's thought, I know you think process is just something that we think about in Washington, but here we are in Washington. So let's talk a little bit about process and your day-to-day life here in the Senate. As someone who's thought about rules and thought about things that maybe could go a little differently in the order of the chamber that you're in now, what would you do to the Senate? Are there things that you did in North Carolina that you think would improve the process here?
Yeah, you know, some of that may relate as much to our conference rules as it does to the Senate rules. You know, for me, I was on a working group that took a look at certain things that we may want to consider changes to the Senate rules. But I think a lot of it is really changing behavior, not necessarily changing the rules. I think when you get into the conference, there's I think that we miss an opportunity to engage a broader base of people. It's similar in concept to what I observed down in the state house, but you know some of these are going to be impossible to change. I mean, to me, the seniority should be some factor, but shouldn't be the guiding factor necessarily for exactly how leadership is assigned or how chairmanships are assigned. I feel like you have to choose a major and a minor if you want to be an elected leader. Perhaps you shouldn't be a chair. If you want to be a chair, you want to legislate, you want to lead. Those sorts of things are just basic organizational principles.
And that committee chairmanships shouldn't be just if you've been on the committee for the longest.
Right. I think that can be a factor, maybe a tiebreaker, but not something that's just predetermined.
Is that at the discretion
and I think,
of the leadership?
And by the way, I think if you do that, that many of the current chairs will continue to be chairs. But just having that as a I think, as a it is written sort of tradition, could potentially put you in a position to where you have someone with a unique set of skills that may need to be played up earlier than mm-hmm. 2 terms or 3 terms into their tenure.
And so is that at the discretion of the leadership to choose the committee chairs in your sense of how this would go?
Well, it's subject to some of the rules. If you take a look at term limits on mm-hmm. Committee chairs, chairmanships, those things are more or less subject to the rules of the guy in the conference, which are self-imposed
rules. But in
rules.
Terms of how you think it should be?
Yeah, I think I think that providing the leadership or maybe even some other body within the conference to really play a role in there would be helpful. Something to look at. I mean, we haven't changed these for
a long time.
Yeah, a long time. I'm thinking leisure suits were popular and probably even sooner or later or longer than that. But
and so it's committee chairmanships and the pick a role, basically, leader or
right, leader, chair. Legislate.
Are there other things that you think would, again, calling on that experience in North Carolina about whether it's the rules of the Senate mm-hmm. or the rules of the conference?
No, I think those are the basic ones. We're right now going through a process of looking at them. You know, my first 2 years here were really to sit back and learn mm-hmm. and not pretend that because I got elected, I became an expert in Washington. Because frankly, I didn't even follow Washington that much until I finally decided to run for the Senate. So it was really spending that time to observe how things are working, what things may be able to be changed or at least discussed in terms of potential changes. And now I'm entering a phase to where I'm more likely to spend a little bit of time not being overly disruptive. This isn't a sea change, but just things that you always look at to try and get the most out of a great group of very capable people.
John McCain said in the context of the healthcare votes that the process is broken and that the Senate needs to get back to doing things the way that it used to be. Do you think that there's anything to that? Should it revert back to how things were, regular order and committee hearings, that kind of stuff that he spoke out about? Or are we talking about something that is?
Well, the only way the idealized view of what Senator McCain's talking about, if other people change behavior and actually would participate in that process in earnest. Look, I get it. If I'm Chuck Schumer, I'm calling for regular order because he knows he can use every device possible to have nothing happen. And so that's why it is critically important for our leadership and why I support Mitch in saying we'll go down that path, but when we know how the movie is going to end and the only thing that will have happened is we will have lost weeks or months of chamber time, then we're not going to take that bait. So until you see a change in behavior where Senator Schumer and key members of the minority conference are willing to come together and say, you know, this is broadly where we're willing to negotiate. We will negotiate in good faith. We will go into committees and markups, and we won't play all the sort of delay tactics and the things that I've seen over the last 3 years. Then that's to me, it's a very noble purpose, but it doesn't really exhibit any grasp of what's been going on around here in terms of the tactics used by the minority. And incidentally, I'll say minority because there's similar criticism that could probably be placed on Republicans when they were in the minority.
Sure. I mean, right. The nuclear option was something that Republicans were very opposed to when the Democrats did it to change the rules on cabinet appointments. Mm-hmm. And then the Democrats, all but one of them, voted for it then. And then all of a sudden, when you guys wanted to change
right.
it about the Supreme Court situation, then it was the Democrats who were saying, this is so terrible. It's the end of the institution. It's like, right.
Right. And, you know, it's all situated. That's one of the reasons why I don't really like inconsistency. When I was in the minority, I was always supportive of independent redistricting mm-hmm. in North Carolina, have some sort of up or down vote, but come up with a new process. When I became speaker, I was also for it. Unfortunately, I couldn't get my caucus or the Senate to agree, but me and the then majority leader were vocally supportive of a different way of doing redistricting to get it out of the courts and get it into a process that we think that most people in North Carolina wanted. So I've got a pretty good track record of not changing, up to and including when I became speaker, changing the Senate rule or the House rules. We got a unanimous vote on the first permanent House rules that we did when I became speaker. Again, the second outright elected Republican speaker in 100 years. It was a huge number of reasons to think the Democrats were even going to make the permanent rules difficult. The reason they voted for them is that what was fundamental to our rules reform were repealing all the rules the majority had passed without any support from the minority that made my job easier. And I told my colleagues I'm perfectly content to learn how to use the rules and do it in a way that doesn't let me hide behind all of these artificial, disingenuous tools that a speaker had where he didn't have to work hard. And so I think that's why we got such a strong vote in the rules. And I think that's one of the reasons why I had a great relationship with the vast majority of Democrats, some of whom I would never be voting with on the same side, but at least we showed them some respect in the process.
The independent redistricting support is something that I'll admit I'm a little surprised by, right?
I supported term limits, too, on me. As the Speaker of the House.
Would you support term limits in the Senate?
I think that we have to look at term limits of some sort. I'm not of the mind. I would vote for any term limit bill, but I think some are more elegant and less risky than others. I think one thing, if you create real term limits on leadership and chairmanships, that will create a natural turnover, because after somebody's aspired to that level, they're less likely to go in the rank and file if they know that that's where they'll be for the remainder of their tenure. So I think there's a more elegant way of doing it that makes it less likely that the staff and the bureaucrats really become the governing entity, and we just become actors in the show that come and go every 12 years.
That is one of the complaints that comes up about term limits. So let's come back to redistricting. So would you want there to be independent redistricting in North Carolina? I mean, the maps that you supported were
but then again, if you pay attention to North Carolina history, they've always been leaning in the direction of whatever party was in power.
Sure.
So there hasn't really been any instance where the party didn't do what it legally believes it can do, is take political considerations in at some point in the process. But I'd like to remove it. I mean, get to a point to where the legislature would still have an up or down vote, but have some independent body coming up with districts. I've supported it publicly ever since I've been in office.
That case that's in front of the Supreme Court about redistricting, that's not one that you hope turns out in favor of where the anti-gerrymandering people are, right? I
mean, yeah, that because it's before the Supreme Court and it relates back to many of my colleagues there, I wouldn't speak on it except to say that you completely change the narrative when you have an independent entity weighing in on the line drawn.
Can I read you some quotes from a person that you may be getting to know a little bit? Homosexual conduct should be illegal. False religions like Islam are against the First Amendment. You know who I'm reading from. Maybe Putin is right. Are you looking forward to Roy Moore from Alabama joining the Republican conference if he wins?
I am. I have always had the view that I don't judge other people until I've had an opportunity to work with them. On its face, there are comments there that are not me that I would completely disagree with. But I had a very diverse conference in North Carolina, and I found a way to work with some people who in abstract may not be far away from that going in position. But look, I don't think it's good leadership just to judge somebody based on other people's impressions or comments that they've made, that some maybe you can just take at face value. Others may relate to context. So we'll wait and see when he gets up here. I hope he wins the election.
I've talked to some of your colleagues about this who are nervous about him coming because, and some of your Republican colleagues, I should point out, because they feel like, in addition to positions like those, they're concerned about the possibility that a senator more would sort of disrupt the order, or would not be voting with the conference on things and slow things down. Do you share those concerns?
Not yet. and I say that because I've never even met them. Outside of what I've seen on TV and tracking the race, I can't measure. You know, I can't come up with any way to have concern or to have no concern. It's an unknown quantity. It's like any other person that comes into a conference or comes into a business.
But he's not really like any other, right? Other Republican senators who joined the conference, or some who joined after winning races last year, are people that you would not have had the same view of, right, that you do of Moore.
I think, you know, that Mr. Moore has never really served in a legislative body. And I do think that when people come into these organizations, you do see some of them change the way that they go about arriving at conclusions. Frankly, I would be shocked if Mr. Moore and I disagreed on 60% of the policies that would come before the conference just going in. Mm-hmm. So the question is, where would
he's
we be?
He's a Republican, right?
Right, right. You know. And so, you know, the questions about his style or whatever else I think are premature. I mean, in the same way that he may have read some report about me and judged me before he's gotten
you
to know me.
You think somebody's reading him quotes from Tom Tillis?
Yeah, you know, you never know.
I wonder what happens if, and it's possible that a year or two from now we'll have a number of members of the Senate who are people who will be looking for ways to not join the conference on votes, right? Mm-hmm. Because they'll be holding out. You see that dynamic happening in the House already. What happens then? What do you guys do?
The electorate takes care of it. I mean, people can, you know, if you, the, people have one of two reasons to come to Congress, to make a point or make a difference. And making a point, if all you're doing is taking a position that prevents the vast majority of your colleagues to get something done, sooner or later we will all be held accountable for that. So I think it's self-regulating over time. And so I think that I hope that we all recognize the American people expect a result. I've said to a certain amount of criticism that I didn't view last year's election as a conservative mandate. I viewed it as a results mandate. And if we don't produce a result, if people think that it's going to resonate over time, that I stood on principle, but I allowed Obamacare to remain the law of the land. I stood on principle, so I allowed the United States to continue to be one of the highest taxed countries in the nation. I stood on principle and therefore didn't allow us to provide the resources to the military. I think all those things over time will have consequences back in their home states.
When people will call you a rhino for that, I know you like that.
I'm a Republican in need of outcomes. And I think that, you know, I would challenge anyone to find someone else in Washington who has literally either been the primary bill writer or the person who ratified more conservative bills than I did in North Carolina in 4 years. So we can talk about the things that you may want to do. I remember in my time as partner at Price Waterhouse, we hired from the elite schools. You had to have a 3.5 GPA or better to even get an interview. You'd bring in a lot of these really bright, talented, energetic people that you concluded over time couldn't get anything done. They could talk about a lot of good ideas, but they could never actually implement them.
And you didn't get your own college degree until late in life.
No, 37 almost. I was 36, going a couple of months from 37, but late bloomer academically. But I think that that at the end of the day, if you can point to a body of work, it's pretty easy to diffuse what the talking heads will say about you and how you're not a true conservative or you're a rhino or all the other name calling, which I'm not prone to do.
But, I mean, it seems like there's that danger in the way that things are going now, that the party, that there are people in the party who want to say, unless you are for standing against everything, then you're not doing what the people want.
But the same thing's going on in the Democratic Party.
Certainly.
You know, unless you're for a single-payer system, unless you're for nationalizing the banking system, unless you hate all big businesses because they're bad and evil, you're not a true Democrat. So they've got the same. In some respects, I think they have a little bit more complexity because there's, you know, two or three groups that are coalescing around a set of ideas that if you're not just like them, you're not a true Democrat. You saw that play out with Bernie.
Yep.
And with Clinton and the campaign. So I think in some respects, we've got the group of us who are sound conservatives, have a track record on it, but recognize that perfect never gets done. A good outcome is better than no outcome, and perfect outcomes don't happen here. So I think in some respects, we have a smaller group of people we have to get on board on a transactional basis. You know, I'm sure that over the course of my tenure, I may have a vote that I feel so strongly about at a conscience level that I may disagree with the leadership and vote a different way. But that's not my go-to position. You know, I told all my members when I was a minority whip and speaker, I said, you got three C's to come up with how you're going to vote on a bill. You always vote your conscience, even if it's in conflict with your constituents. Never take that step down the slippery slope. If your conscience isn't driving you, and most of this stuff isn't about conscience, listen to your constituents. And only if your conscience or your constituents are not telling you how to vote, then listen to your conference. I called it the three C's and said, you know, look, if you're at odds with the conference, just tell the leader you're at odds with them and vote.
But again, like if you have these people in there who are voting, who turn out to not be voting with the conference, are they Republicans then?
Yeah, they are. I mean, look, to me, it's all transactional. I mean, if you look at the ones that we want to famously talk about because we're one vote shy or two votes right. shy, take a look at their body of work. I mean, they've voted with the vast majority of the stuff that we're doing here. Yeah. But we amplify the handful where maybe they decide to go a different way.
I mean, it's funny with McCain, obviously, he was the vote very dramatically in the middle of the night in July against Obamacare. He didn't vote for Graham Cassidy, and that helped end that. The Democrats all of a sudden, oh, he's a hero, right? Mm-hmm. And there were some Republicans, hey, he's John McCain, right? He has been a pretty strong and with it Republican for a very long time, who was your nominee mm-hmm. all of 9 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. He's not out of the party at this point, right?
No, he's not. He's still very well regarded. He's a great Senate Armed Services Committee chair. A lot of people, including me, were frustrated with that vote.
Yeah,
but that you know, you just move on. That's one thing that I actually enjoy about this job. There are some things I don't, but I like the fact that you know it's sort of like my Carolina Panthers. They had a lousy game yesterday. I mean, awful game. I can't believe we lost to the Bears. But I'm back watching the game next week and the week after that and the week after that, and we'll have some good outcomes. So I think that's how you have to look at it. You can't let any one vote or position somebody takes let you or cloud your judgment about the relationship you're going to have with them and finding the opportunities to work with them.
Well, let's talk about the Dreamers, and immigration is an issue that you spent a lot of time thinking about. We have a conversation coming with Nancy Pelosi that will run a little bit, in which she says that she thinks that she will oversee a deal by the end of the year that will include the debt ceiling, budget, and a legalization path for the mm-hmm. Dreamers. She thinks it's pretty much, she said to me, that's the plan, but feels very confident about it. Is that going to happen?
She better have a lot of votes that she can bring, because I actually think there's a lot of structural problems with that. I mean, a straight-up DACA provision and the year-end appropriations bill could be the reason why it's the first appropriations bill I don't vote for. Because you do see some – you can see some folks here who are just trying to run out the clock and then hope that they can get that measure on and threaten government shutdown. So maybe she has a reason to believe that other than her own opinion of – the role that she can play in getting a year-end deal. But I think that that's a great disservice to the Dreamers. I think it's a great disservice to the issue. And it literally poisons the well for any other future productive discussion around immigration reform. Yeah. If you want to set back the rest of the discussion we want to have around immigration reform back by about 20 years, then let her be successful with this sort of shove it down people's throats approach. I think it's a great disservice to the illegal to the immigrant population if she did that.
The immigration debate is set back pretty far, it would seem already.
No, actually, I think if you come up with a way where you get the not usual suspects supporting a bill like the bill that we've proposed with the SUCCEED Act or some variant that gets the votes. That's going to be one of the first meaningful, broad-based immigration reform bills that have been done here in decades. And then you've got to talk about H1A or H1B, H2A, mm-hmm. H2B, the alphabet soup of guest worker programs and visas mm-hmm. that also we need to work on. So I think somebody who would just kind of use political gamesmanship to get this done is doing a great disservice to the rest of that population of immigration issues that I hope that we solve versus just play politics.
Well, one of the things that seems to have given her confidence was that tweet that the president put out, that tweet which she encouraged him to do, which said that the Dreamers have nothing to worry about. When you were in that hearing with Attorney General Sessions last week, you asked him what he meant. You asked the Attorney General what the president meant by that tweet, and he told you he wasn't sure. Do you know where the president is on this?
I think the president truly does want to come up with a solution for the DACA population. But I believe he also has a number of people who are advising him on how the immigration issue goes far beyond the DACA population. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember which tweet you're talking about because there were a lot between, say, September 5th and later on in the month.
There are always a lot of tweets from the president.
But if Minority Leader Pelosi is talking about the tweet where it looked like they were close to a deal, that got I think that got discounted within about 24 hours. And I think what we've seen now is that the president may be wanting to move, in my opinion, a little bit too rapidly towards subsequent phases of immigration reform that we have to solve. So if she's got that as a guidepost for why she thinks she can get this done, she may want to talk with the president again.
Well, I think part of it is this feeling of the only thing that legislatively has moved that's been big has been this deal that she and Chuck Schumer got him to agree with about pushing a 3-month, right? And that is in her head and it says to her, well, we got things done and you guys didn't. So.
Good for her.
But she also looks at it and says, and has said publicly, right, that you guys have the majority, and if the government shuts down, that's not going to be something that is on her conscience.
Well, I think that we have to look back in history when we've seen members of the minority shut down the government, how that worked out for them. And what we have to do is take a look and see, you know, what the basis of it would be. I mean,
but members of the minority have never shut down the government, right? It was in 94, and Newt Gingrich was the speaker, right?
Well, no matter what the
2013, you were in the minority in the Senate, but in the majority in the House.
Well, I was referring to the minority in the Senate, where the Republican Party kind of owns the party of shutdown. But I think what we have to do is communicate why it would be that someone like Pelosi or some member of the Senate cast light on what they're saying rises to a level of importance that's greater than funding the government. Mm-hmm. And we just can't naturally assume that we'd be responsible for it unless we accept the position of the minority. I mean, that's almost a mentality for negotiating as if you're in the minority. And on the budget bill, I think we need to be prepared to stand firm and not take whatever we have to get a year-end deal if we don't think that it's responsible and also harmful to other things that we're trying to get done, like immigration reform.
I mean, have you communicated that to your friends in the House? Because to her sense of it, and it's not just hers, I've heard this from a lot of House Democrats, is they have the majority of votes. They could pass a funding bill. They don't need any Democratic mm-hmm. votes, but we're not going to give them any Democratic votes to compensate for lost Republican votes unless they give us something. Right?
Yeah, so. I think most of that's more driven by how the minority leader may be looking, the House minority leader may be looking at the dynamic in the Senate, less so than what it takes to get out of the House.
What do you mean?
We know we need to get to 60.
Yeah.
And we know that that's going to be difficult with a couple of our members. Anything that would attract any number of Democrats would almost automatically lose two or three members. So we've got a 11-vote threshold to get to, in my mind, to get the year in. So I think she's probably thinking more about what happens over here and what that year-end package is going to look like than what's happening over in the House.
Yeah. Let's talk about healthcare. You would like to see something happen here, and not just you wish that John McCain and Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins had voted with you in July, but now we're staring down the barrel of the subsidies that the president has said he won't be providing anymore to the insurance companies. What happens from here to make this a sustainable, not chaotic situation?
Well, I think some of what first I voted for the health care bill in August. I would have voted for Graham Cassidy if we thought that we had the votes to it. I would have supported just taking a vote even if we knew we were going to fail. But I respect the leader's judgment. It didn't make sense if we knew it wasn't going to succeed. If we're not able to get that baseline and reconciliation now is more or less off the table because we're on to the new budget, new reconciliation instructions, then we've got to look at things that if we come to terms and accept something far less as a first step, then we're going to get a lot of heat from the right saying you didn't repeal Obamacare. But we've got to make progress. I mean, we've got a failed system. I mean, the vote in August and Graham Cassidy wasn't a here's a repeal and replace for Obamacare, now we can go do all these other things. It was the beginning of a process that still has to be completed.
Do you know where the president stands on health care at this point, what he wants to do legislatively?
I think that the stabilizing the markets and trying to get to that trend of more state-focused initiatives is really what the White House wants to see. We're going to have some difference of opinion about the cost-sharing reductions, but the reality is the industry, the insurers, the providers, everybody else has had 7 years to deal with Obamacare. Yeah. And that this policy, whether you agree with it or not, is a part of the underlying foundation of health care for the population affected by the Affordable Care Act. So you just can't overnight take that away. You have to have some way to give a year or two of transition time so that the market can react appropriately and factor in all the other changes that would occur after this first bill's passed. So the stuff that Senator Alexander's working on with Senator Murray is something I'm open to. I haven't committed to support it. Certainly haven't said that I oppose it.
Does it make it trickier when we get the president saying different things about where he stands on bill? There was a period last week or one day where he said, I think it was three different positions about the health care bill.
Yeah, I think the president is trying to continue to get people to start thinking beyond just maybe one initiative like the Alexander or Murray effort, but think more broadly about all
this
the things
strategic
that have to be fixed.
In your mind, that the different positions are because he's trying to spur people to.
I think it reminds me of when I worked in research and development back in the 1980s, and really innovative technology, artificial intelligence back in its very early stages. And in some respects, I see some of the things that President Trump doing remind me a lot of some of the most brilliant people I'd have in a work group setting, just throwing out what on their face looked like crazy ideas that ultimately served as a purpose for getting to a good outcome. So
You think is going on?
I think that's part of it. I think part of it's just his personality, but I do think that he's constantly thinking, and I think that he's constantly getting advice from several different people who may not have fully reconciled their opinions against one another. And he's
right, because the way
voicing those.
A lot of people seem to interpret this is that he'll hear like the latest thing from somebody and then take that position, and that he's meanwhile not digging deep into the details of these policy matters.
Well, I can't. You know, no president.
I mean, you're being very generous with that this is all strategic and.
Well, I didn't say it was all strategic, but I do think that the president. I mean, just imagine the job that he has with all the people coming in, many of them experts in their field, and he's not necessarily a subject matter expert in healthcare. He probably could go toe to toe with anybody in the industry that he was very successful in, but. So he's hearing these things. They kind of make sense. So he puts them out there for consideration. I don't think that's I think too much of that could give us too many shiny objects so we don't get to an outcome. Some of that's helpful because it stretches people's thinking.
Yeah. Do you, you're in addition to your day job in the Senate, you're the finance chair for the Republican Senate Campaign Committee, NRSC. What do you think donors are going to do if you guys don't have more results to show for being in charge legislatively? That worry is going around a lot.
I think that people are expecting an outcome. And they're not asking for a specific thing. It's not like if you don't pass health care with all these provisions in it, I'm not for you. They're not at that level. They're at that macro level, which is you promised repealing, replacing Obamacare, getting health care on sound footing. You promised that you would take a look at the tax code and make us more competitive. We'll let you all sweat the details, but we expect an outcome. And I think if we fail to produce an outcome, then it will be a very difficult couple of cycles in the U.S. Senate and the House.
You think you're going to lose seats?
I think
if you don't pass tax reform, which is the next thing up,
it will dramatically increase the chance. We obviously in the Senate we have very favorable maps.
Yep,
we have 10 states that President Trump carried half of them by more than 17%. So I think that we've got very favorable maps, and I am optimistic that if we produce an outcome on tax reform, that we're going to have a very strong position going in the U.S. Senate. We'll most likely pick up seats.
But if you don't?
If we don't, then I think we will be fighting hand-to-hand in every state to point to the records of the members who are up for reelection and then point to the credentials and the quality of the candidates we have in these other states that we're targeting.
What do you think of Steve Bannon?
I think Steve Bannon – I actually – up until probably about 6 months ago, couldn't have picked him out of a lineup. I really didn't follow him that much. I don't read Breitbart, and I don't read Huffington Post. I'm balanced that way. I think that he's a useful voice. I mean, all these—
Is he a useful voice in saying that he'll primary Republicans and he'll back people who don't fight what the conference is doing on a lot of things? Is that useful?
I don't think it's particularly. First off, I don't really know if I were to go into a. I always do the Starbucks test or coffee shop test. If you don't have Starbucks nearby, I'm pretty sure even in North Carolina, if I went to a Starbucks and asked people, "Do you know who Tom Tillis is?" Maybe 4 out of 10 would know, only because I've been around the state for 10 or 12 years. If you ask people who Steve Bannon was, it's probably 1 or 2 out of 10.
Yeah.
So we may have an overinflated view of just how important any one of us is here. At the end of the day, if we produce a result, then most reasonable-minded people will say the Republicans produced a result. We owe them an opportunity to continue to build on it.
But is he helpful to the cause?
I don't think, like I said, I don't know that he's either helpful or harmful. I just think he's someone out there with an opinion, like a lot of other people, the talking heads on TV, which is why you see I have Bloomberg on my television set, because I don't watch all the other talking heads.
That's why we're on a podcast. Let me ask you two more, and then we'll finish up. When Senator Corker, your colleague from Tennessee, spoke out against the president, one of the things that a lot of people said was that he was saying things. So you're smiling already, right? He was saying things that you guys are many of you thinking, but not saying out loud. Is that fair?
Well, look, I will tell you that Senator Corker behaved in exactly the same way that I would if I had something waged at me that I thought was unfair or inappropriate. So I think that he was perfectly entitled to respond. I hate to see that kind of public exchange go on between two Republicans, but at a point where it becomes personal— then I think that a senator should be able to stand
but
up
it's
and
more
say
than
what
personal,
he wants
right?
to say.
He said that he thinks that the president could lead us to World War III.
Well, I think you got to go back to the context, because it was just a sort of a scaling up of
yeah, it was a Sunday yeah. where everything kind of got very busy.
Yeah, so I think it was more or less of a I think the word choice should be different, because I think that we have a role to try and calm the nerves of other people and then yeah. solve the problems. And every once in a while in this environment that we're in, and it predates President Trump. I mean, it's the advent of social media. Yeah. Things spin up really quickly. People cut right to it because they think they've only got 140 characters to make a point or make a story. And but, I think that that's a consequence of
but
that.
But you didn't answer the question exactly. Is he saying things out loud that other that you and other senators are thinking privately?
They, you know, I think that quite honestly, I don't watch social media mainly because I think it's just a it's a series of baits laid out.
But he wasn't
there
talking just about the tweets. He was talking about the president's overall approach to foreign policy and to domestic policy too.
Yeah,
I mean, do you have those concerns?
Well, I actually have had as much of a concern with the prior administration's lack of engagement. And so if you take a look at the North Korea, I think that some of what I see the president doing, maybe we've tried through three administrations this sort of a passive, we hope you'll do better North Korea approach, and it hasn't worked particularly well. So I think some of what, going back to that R&D mindset, I think some of what the president's doing is trying to maybe use words and tactics that may resonate with the leadership in North Korea. It is absolutely unorthodox, but the situation is going to get more dangerous if we just can't continue the status quo. Yeah. It was not working, and North Korea is far more dangerous this year than they were 8 years ago. So I think some of that could put people out of their comfort zone, particularly people that have been in the roles that someone like a Senator Corker has, where he's spent a lot of time in foreign relations, foreign policy. I'm less encumbered by that because I don't have that much experience. 3 years ago, foreign policy to me was South Carolina and Tennessee.
So, but I feel like on that question, we have to put you down as like not a solid yes or not a solid no.
Yeah. You know, I think there are certain things that are said that aren't helpful. You know, look, I would not tell you that every position that the president's taken is something that I would agree with or that don't object to. I just think I have a different approach to dealing with it on matters of policy. When it gets down to matters of personality, then my trailer park upbringing could come back out, and I'll take that on one-on-one. It hadn't happened yet. I hope
it
never does.
You're not much of a tweeter, so it will have to happen maybe face-to-face.
I tweet. But a part of that is because I was very actively
trailer
engaged
park
in social
upbringing
media.
Doesn't usually lead to tweeting.
Well, I just don't like, you know, all these sort of confrontations that I see. I'd really like to avoid because I think most people, at the end of the day, their heart's in the right place. They just need to get their heads there so we're communicating, working more closely together.
All right, last one here. The president has done a fair amount to already start changing how people think of the Republican Party, what the Republican Party focuses on. Does he make you proud to be a Republican?
I'm actually proud to be a Republican based on the ideals that being a conservative stands for. So I don't need any one person to. Mm-hmm. I've been a Republican. I grew up in a Democrat family when I was 18 years old. I had my first opportunity to vote. I voted Republican, and I voted.
So which race was that?
Republican. It was when I lived in Tennessee, and I ultimately voted for Lamar Alexander when he ran for governor before I moved to all of these other states.
Has that helped to ingratiate you to him?
I did remind him of that because I remember the plaid flannel
playing the piano
walking tour across Tennessee. But you know, I'm proud to be a Republican because I'm fundamentally a conservative. Mm-hmm. And I've never really been one of these people that say I'm a Republican because Ronald Reagan was a Republican or because Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. I'm a Republican because I more closely identify with what defines a conservative. I'm proud to be a Republican because of what we stand for, not because of any one person who also happens to be a Republican.
All right. We'll leave it there. Senator Tom Tillis, thanks
Thank
for taking
you.
The time.
I enjoyed it.
That was Tom Tillis, Senator from North Carolina. Thanks as always to Bridget Mulcahy for producing, with help this week from Beatrice Peterson and Zach Stanton. Have you subscribed yet? Have you told a friend yet? Get on it. Nancy Pelosi, Eric Holder, William Perry, and more coming up. Catch you next time on Off Message.